You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. It's a three-letter abbreviation kind of day around here. UAW, IPO, from APM. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 18th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, the UAW strike. It's a story about worker pay and benefits, of course. It's a story about corporate profits, too, and CEO pay. It's also, though, a bigger story about dealerships. We called some of them on Friday. About the regional Midwest economy. Did that the other day. Towns and cities closest to the plants that are being struck and what's happening or might happen there. But it's a supply chain story, too. The nuts and bolts, almost literally, of how cars get made and repaired. Parts suppliers are obviously going to be watching closely how this strike plays out. But even now, after the pandemic crunch and the chip shortages have largely been resolved, car parts are still kind of hard to come by. Marketplace's Henry Epp gets us going with today's macroeconomic why story.
Most car parts are pretty easy to find these days for Brian Meglin, owner of Brian's North End Automotive, an independent repair shop in Burlington, Vermont.
Tires, brakes, exhaust, engine parts.
But there's this one 2015 Chevy Volt he takes care of that needs a rear spring, and he says the only place he can get it is from a dealership.
I ordered that spring, I want to say, back in May, and there's still no date as to whether, you know, when I'm going to see this spring.
Meglin is running into the same problem a lot of dealerships are facing right now, says Todd Campo with S&P Global Mobility.
Typically, dealerships prefer, obviously, to use the genuine branded part for whatever brand they're servicing.
And those brands, Ford, GM, they're still playing catch-up after that chip shortage, says Patrick Olson, editor-in-chief at Carfax.
And now, while demand for new cars is pretty high, they really want to prioritize putting parts into those new cars versus into repair parts.
And that's a problem, Olson says, because our old cars are getting older.
People holding onto their cars and maintaining them, and that's great, but it also means that parts fail and people wind up in accidents. And so that overall age means that there's just more work that needs to be done.
There is one factor that could increase the supply of auto parts, says Todd Campo at S&P Global, the UAW strike. If the big three automakers slash production, suppliers could turn their attention away from parts for new vehicles.
If this strike elongates, you could potentially see tier one suppliers set up tooling to build back their repair stock.
So maybe that Chevy Volt in Burlington will finally get that spring it needs. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, so little movement, we got to go to three decimal places to get you the percentage change. We're not going to do that, but we will have the details when we do the numbers. After a pandemic-induced freeze in the IPO market, public stock offerings are heating up again. The British chip designer Arm had quite the debut last week. Tomorrow, it is a darling of the pandemic economy. Instacart is going to be offering itself at $28 to $30 a share, looking for a total valuation bumping up against $10 billion. Of course, the appetite for food delivery isn't quite as voracious as it was back in 2020, but Instacart has found another way to make money. Advertising. Nearly a third of the company's revenue last year came from ad and software sales. That is from its prospectus. And Instacart's not the first e-commerce service to make that pivot either. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on the rise of retail media networks.
Businesses like Instacart, Amazon, or Uber have the things they're actually selling. Your yogurt, no-name electronics, rides to the airport. But Forrester retail analyst Sucharita Kadali says they're also increasingly selling your eyeballs.
You search for yogurt and there's like a Chobani ad, and it's more lucrative to sell an ad than it is to actually, in many cases, sell the yogurt.
Most of us are used to ads on websites or apps, but Garrett Johnson, a marketing professor at Boston University, says advertising on retail sites specifically is becoming ubiquitous.
Uber, Lowe's, Home Depot, DoorDash, Uber Eats, CVS, Walgreens, Macy's, like the list just goes on and on and on.
Johnson says there's a crackdown on data privacy in some countries and states, plus policies that make it easier for consumers to opt out of mobile app tracking have made targeted advertising more difficult. That's made e-commerce sites with their ample data about users even more attractive to advertisers. Vijay Gurbaksani is a professor of business and computer science at UC Irvine.
They are capturing consumers with a very, very strong intent to purchase. I don't go to Instacart to hang out or read something, right? I go to Instacart to buy something.
But relying on advertising too much can turn customers off, says Caitlin Sikowski with market research firm Mintel.
It's just the amount that you're exposed to while trying to live your everyday life can really put it like a sour taste in your mouth.
In Mintel surveys, almost three quarters of consumers say they'd stop visiting a website if too many ads interfered. And losing those eyeballs cancels out the whole point of advertising. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Among the sectors of the Chinese economy that were hit hard by the three or so years of zero COVID over there, retail supermarkets is high up on that list. Since 2020, supermarket chains Yonghui and Carrefour have shut down something like 600 stores. Walmart closed at 90. Yet its wholesale chain, Sam's Club, has actually been expanding, as have been its competitors. Turns out in China, it's a bit of a status symbol to buy in bulk. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack went shopping in Shanghai.
Today I'm going to take you to a place I've never been, Sam's Club. But I can't step inside the enormous suburban outlet half an hour's drive from central Shanghai without a membership. So I've brought my good friend Daisy Guo, who's been a Sam's Club member since last year.
Yeah, the first I hear about that is really weird, why I should buy the membership to buy something, but I don't know. I mean, it's just I heard about it. It's really cheap and fancy foods and just kind of interesting to look into that.
Today, she's renewing her membership. The basic one is $36 a year, which she will split with a friend because she thinks the fee is a tad expensive.
Wow, 大闸蟹, oh my God.
Daisy hasn't been back for a while, so she's amazed at the gift cards for hairy crab, the variety of instant noodles, and huge bottles of Thai chili sauce. I am amazed at how busy it is for a Monday.
Okay, what is grabbing you here? I like the mashu.
Mashu, Korean chewy bread made out of sticky rice, that's one of the hot ticket items on Chinese social media, like the photo-rich Xiaohongshu. That's where many Chinese customers find out what places like Sam's Club are selling.
You know, every time Sam's Club come up with a new product and the Xiaohongshu, they will, so many bloggers, they will test it and buy it home and take a video. And
so you actually watch reviews?
Of course.
But do you do this for any other grocery market?
No.
Oh, Hema.
Hema of the Alibaba Group is a competitor to Sam's Club. Those reviews Daisy checks out are so important because the whole shopping experience at membership clubs is so new to the Chinese. In a country of over a billion people, there's only 4 Costcos and 45 Sam's Clubs. And competition, even with Chinese membership clubs, is fierce. A price war recently broke out
as seen on TikTok's Chinese sister site, Douyin. Sam's Club had a durian-flavored crepe cake for 128 yuan, 18 bucks. Then Hema sold its durian cake cheaper, at 99. Sam's Club discounted its cake to 98.9, Hema countered with 89. You get the idea. Sam's Club and others are targeting China's aspirational consumers in its middle class. Not only do you need a membership, you need a car to haul that stuff home, and a big enough home to store all the stuff. But within that class, there's a huge range of income levels.
Sam's Club opened about a year ago in my neighborhood, just like 2 miles away.
That's Charles Zhang, Marketplace's news assistant. He says to entice people in his middle-class area, Sam's Club was offering a bag of rice or cooking oil as a bonus gift just to sign up. He wasn't sold. But it became a bragging point for neighbors who did sign up, a status symbol.
So yeah, just one night after supper, my mom was sitting outside, and then a neighbor, elderly, suddenly out of nowhere, she said, "Did you go to Sam's Club?" So that question to my mom is kind of to show I have a membership and you don't. And I want to remind you that.
Daisy and I, with Charles in tow, finish shopping and sort out the cart.
Some lady just came over just to see what we bought, just to see reference for the...
We were checking out what others were buying too. The customer at the checkout in front of us had two carts full of mostly meat. Sam's Club is known for its higher quality beef in China, and it isn't cheap. Her total came to $1,200. That's nothing, says the checkout lady. She says she's seen people easily spend over $2,000, especially over the holidays. By comparison, Daisy was restrained and spent about 50 bucks today.
Okay, what do you think of our shopping trip today?
So happy.
So happy. Okay,
成功.
Later, Daisy told me her nosy neighbor gave her shopping the once-over and told her, you've bought a lot from Sam's Club. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
U.S. gross domestic product, which is a fancy way of referring to the size of the American economy, is, give or take, $23 trillion. A little bit more, actually. So with that as the denominator, which is the number on the bottom, $454 billion as the numerator isn't that much percentage-wise. But it is $454 billion, which is a pile of money. It's also how much we collectively spend on outdoor recreation in this country. It gets spent everywhere on a lot of different things, including in some out-of-the-way places and on some dusty trails in the American West. From Wyoming Public Radio, Caitlin Tan has our story.
Pamela and Tim Fennell from Indiana pedal their tandem bike down a dusty dirt road. It has two seats, two handlebars, two sets of pedals. Bulky bags are strapped all over, carrying everything they need for 2 months on the road.
Yesterday we rode 78 miles.
Which is our longest day.
It's our longest day and almost 4,000 feet of elevation, Clint.
The Fennels are pedaling a rugged route from Canada to Mexico along the Continental Divide. It attracts thousands of hikers and cyclists who, like the Fennels, stop in rural towns along the way.
This is your last stop for real food, to fill up with water, to kind of get yourself geared up.
The Fennels are taking a break here in Atlantic City, Wyoming, not to be confused with the Mecca out east. This Atlantic City is an old gold mining town with no paved roads and a total of 5 businesses. The Fennels expect to spend about $150 here on laundry, showers, a campsite, and most importantly, calories.
We both have bacon cheeseburgers and fries.
And fries.
But we already had an ice cream.
There are dozens of other cyclists and hikers in town, also fueling up and spending money, including here. The Atlantic City Mercantile is decorated like a saloon out of an old Western. Gary Connett is here from Minnesota. Against the old battered wooden bar, you can tell he's not local in his skin-tight spandex shorts and clumpy cycling shoes.
I wanted to see the place. I've always heard about it, so I was really looking forward to just seeing this.
One hiker drinks a beer at the bar. There's a few tables of cyclists eating burgers. Connett says this town is a must-stop for people making this trip.
All the bikers stop here. They don't bike by it. They stop here.
Connett spends about $10 on chips and chocolate milk and hits the road. For the last 50 years or so, Atlantic City has long teetered on the edge of a ghost town, a population of about 57.
Some days, if two of us locals walk in, they've had a busy day.
Susan Lehman is a longtime resident who used to work at the Mercantile.
If you made $5 that day, you've made a lot of money.
The area has gone through some gold mining booms starting in the late 1800s. Now, all that's left of this era are some tattered wooden mine buildings on the outskirts of town. Lehman says the thousands of hikers and cyclists that started coming in the last decade are like another boom.
I suppose it's going to be driven by people's finances, but I think it's going to stay for a while, and it's good for these businesses.
Businesses like the local campground. Owner Lucy Milham sits on her front porch. To her left is a wooden sign engraved with a pistol and the words, "We don't dial 911," a nod to the fact there's no police department here. This is Milham's busy season.
We're basically only open June, July, August, September, because the weather's, you know, you never know. We had 137 inches of snow last year.
But Milham says it's enough to pay her bills. And campers love that there's laundry, a vending machine, and showers.
And there's no place out there on the trail to take a shower. So that's pretty much what they want. They don't even set their tents up. They go right to the shower.
Milham says she's adding more campsites to meet the demand that's now brought on by outdoor recreation and leaving gold mining in the dust. In Atlantic City, Wyoming, I'm Caitlin Tan for Marketplace.
Coming up,
rubber, scrap metal, resin.
Let's play a little word association, shall we? I got nothing on that one. You? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 were all up, but by just about nothing. The Dow ended at 34,624. The NASDAQ finished at 13,710. The S&P 500 ended things at 44,053. Henry Epp was telling us about the difficulty finding some auto parts. So let's check some auto parts share, shall we? AutoZone dipped 0.5%. CarParts.com fell 4%. Shares were down under 0.1% for O'Reilly Auto Parts. I think I got that right. Right? I've heard the ad enough times. Shares of the aforementioned microchip designer Arm Holdings fell back to earth just a little bit, lost 4.5%. Today, you might remember, they were up 25% right out the gate last week in its IPO. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you've been keeping up on the political headlines, you know the disarray among House Republicans has the odds of a government shutdown come the end of the month and thus the end of the fiscal year. Those odds are rising by the day. It would be the fourth government shutdown in a decade, and like the others that came before it, it would disrupt the lives of hundreds of thousands of federal workers. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, that is not making things easy for this country's biggest employer or its biggest workforce.
Even the threat of government shutdowns makes government jobs a lot less appealing, says Max Steyer, who runs the nonprofit Partnership for Public Service.
Because anybody who is thinking about public service and has to consider the risk that Congress doesn't do its job and they're either furloughed or told they must work even though their paycheck's not coming.
Research from the data firm Qualtrics found less than half of recent graduates are even considering working in government.
Shutdown is very bad branding, particularly for students and recent graduates.
Sydney Heimbrock is Qualtrics' chief industry advisor for government. She says shutdowns also make it hard to retain current federal workers.
They're getting tired of being lambasted in political discourse. They're getting tired of being sent home with no pay on an annual basis. And you just can't treat people like that and expect them to have a sense of passion and loyalty to you as an employer.
Federal workers have been paid after past shutdowns, albeit late, but there's no guarantee they'll get back pay for any future shutdown. Vicki Wilkins, who teaches public policy and human resources at American University, says while federal workers seem to have ridden out the shutdown dramas of the recent past,
that may change. That really might change if we continue to have these every few years. And it just does prove to be too much upheaval in their careers and their lives.
Especially given this job market, where plenty of other employers are ready to poach skilled workers for jobs that aren't subject to the whims of some members of Congress. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This is an inexact analogy, but the Mississippi River is about as powerful an economic engine as this country has. Just for instance, just about 60% of our grain exports go down the river by barge. Plenty of livestock and soybeans travel that way, too. Oil and petroleum products as well, as you've heard from our barge guy that we talked to. Hot weather and drought, though, mean lower water levels, which means barges can't carry their usual loads, which is making them less efficient. Eric Schmid from St. Louis Public Radio took a stroll down to the Mississippi.
On a recent sunny day near St. Louis, a towboat slowly maneuvers 15 barges tied together down the Mississippi. The whole vessel is about a quarter mile long, and the barges are filled with either animal feed or oil products. But barges can move a lot of other goods, too.
Rubber, scrap metal, resin for
Paul Rohde is the Midwest Region Vice President for the Waterways Council, an organization that advocates for barge transportation.
It's all about capacity.
He says it would take more than 1,000 semi-trucks to carry the same load as 15 barges.
Barges move products with a much lower carbon footprint than rail or certainly trucks.
Rohde cites a Texas A&M study from 2022 that finds overall, the carbon footprint of barge shipping is 9 times smaller than trucking, and it's about half that of rail. But Olivia Dorothy with American Rivers says that system-wide calculation misses some of the nuances of what it takes to move goods on different waterways.
Just like cars, you've got different fuel economies and emissions when you drive in the city versus when you drive on the highway. And we believe that's the same thing for our rivers.
These are important distinctions, Dorothy says, because the Mississippi River changes so much. For example, going downriver here near St. Louis, it's the last place where barges go through a lock and dam. The lock is like an elevator. Barges going downstream come in and are lowered to the water level in front of the dam. It's a process that takes time, and in terms of carbon emissions, it's sort of like a truck idling at a toll booth. And that's why the environmental advantages are in question.
When you talk about greenhouse gases, the budget fully hasn't been completed.
Jonathan Remo is a professor at Southern Illinois University Carbondale, who studies how humans affect large rivers.
We're not accounting for the impacts of these large structures, these locks and dams we put on the landscape.
There are dozens of them north of St. Louis and on other rivers too, like the Illinois and Ohio, the Columbia, and Lower Snake in the Northwest. Remo says there isn't specific data on how these locks and dams add to the carbon footprint of barge transportation. And that means we don't have a full picture of how green barges really are.
Not having the complete information is like getting a loan and not having what the interest rate is.
And many of these dams are decades old and outdated. The federal government is spending billions of dollars on infrastructure for ports and waterways to keep these transportation systems running. For now, Remo is working to tally up carbon emissions that come from the locks and dams on the upper Mississippi. He says he hopes it will be a tool to help manage our rivers and know with more certainty if barges are a solid climate solution for the shipping industry. In St. Louis, I'm Eric Schmid for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, and yes, I know we are barely halfway through September, but the holiday shopping season doesn't care what the calendar says. Saw this on Reuters that Macy's is going to hire 38,000 seasonal workers this year. That compares to 41,000 last year, so roughly comparable. But here's why I mention it. In 2021, Macy's hired 76,000 extra workers. The unspoken reality here is, of course, that Macy's and other retailers who are reporting similar hiring plans are expecting lower holiday sales. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context. One more item from the calendar. The Fed meets tomorrow and Wednesday. So let's play a little We Report, You Decide, shall we? What do you think? They're going to hike again? Pause, maybe? Those are the only two options, by the way, because a cut is not going to happen. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.